Welcome to Creature Feature, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm your host of Many Parasites, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and today on the show, we're talking animals that are unusually musical. Music isn't just something that nearly every human on the planet loves, but something that can be found from up in the skies to deep under the ocean. And we have a special guest from NASA who uses music to educate and inspire. Discover this and more as we answer the age-old question, do all birds like Taylor Swift or just the Swifts? Joelle Monique, our lovely producer, is back with us again on a hot mic, and joining me today is NASA engineer, creator, educator, and musician Deja Williams. Welcome, Deja.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good. I'm so excited to talk about music with you. It's always fascinated me how it's its own language, where you just like listen to a piece of music and you feel this raw emotion, and it feels like we're sort of connected to the natural world in a way. And so I'm just so excited about this topic, and I'm so excited to have you. I don't think I've ever spoken to anyone from NASA before.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to do this too. I've always had an appreciation for just natural sounds. I love when I see people making instrumentals or beats to like just things that they have at their house, whether it's a pen or like or the wind or the river sound. So I'm super excited to look at music in a different perspective today.
Yes. And we will have an interview with you in the middle of the episode where we will talk about your own musical talent. You create songs to help get people interested in STEM, in math and engineering, which is really exciting. It's a wonderful way to learn through music. This is kind of funny, but I remember I could only learn the U.S. states through that Animaniac song. Do you remember that?
Oklahoma, does it say that?
I don't remember it now, but yeah. As a kid, it helped me. Helped me immensely pass that test.
Yes, I know. I'm trying to think of it so bad. I can't think of how it goes. But yes, that was the song of our fifth grade year. That was our thing.
But it helps unlock a part of your brain, I think. It's like, in fact, like there's this whole thing where people who have suffered some kind of brain trauma, either through a stroke or brain injury, even if they can't talk, sometimes they can still sing. Because it's a different part of the brain. So if the part of the brain that allows them to sing or play music is still functioning, then they can sing and play music, but they can't, like, and they can maybe communicate through using their singing voice instead of their talking voice, which is, I think, really fascinating.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So it's such a mysterious thing, and as we'll talk about later in the episode, some of these mysteries of music, especially when it comes to music in nature, have yet to be discovered, but they are really interesting and really exciting.
Wait, can I ask before we move on, Deja, how'd you get into like music?
Oh my God, great question. So I got into music. My family played a huge influence. Every year we have this thing. It's not necessarily a family reunion. We call it a pig party. But everybody goes down to Atlanta, and we have a talent show where everybody in the family has to participate, especially the kids. So I would have my bigger cousins write me raps and things of that sort. Or I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, so Nelly was huge at the time. So we would always like rap Nelly song. So that's what got me like in tune with music, trying to be prepared for the family talent show.
How'd you do?
I did pretty good. My cousins always beat me out, but look, I'm the one doing the music now.
Hey.
So, you know, I gotta make sure that they don't hear this. Oh my God.
You're calling them out.
I am.
Speaking of learning music from a young age, I do want to talk first about birds, which I think are the most iconic animal musicians. It's the iconic animal who makes music in a way where we feel that by just hearing them sing, we can sort of understand them in a way that is otherwise hard to understand. Joelle, I know that your relationships with birds is a little bit
iffy. Oh, I have.
It, listen, even bird calls, which we all know are actually dinosaur screams, are, they vary. Some are very nice, and you're like, wow, what a wonderful way to, like, wake up in the morning. And sometimes a giant raven is sitting in the palm tree outside of your house staring at you singing, and you're like, I know you hold grudges. I feel like I haven't done anything specifically to you, but maybe the birds know that I'm afraid of them, and they're stalking my space. I don't know. I want to love the bird music because I know it's important to them. I know it's like what keeps them alive and how to communicate and find a partner and stuff. It's very romantic. I'm still horrified of the dinosaur screeches that accompany every sunrise. That's very metal. It's scary.
That is hilarious. The cousin who actually puts on the pig party, he actually is scared of birds himself. And he calls it, he says that him and birds just have a misunderstanding. He doesn't like to say that he's scared of them. He just said, yeah, we just have a little misunderstanding. Nothing too crazy.
Look, they can do their things. I'm not the kind of person who advocates, like, throwing rocks at birds or, like, no. Running at them so they're scared. None of that. You know, I would just like them to stay over there and I'll just be over here and we're good. Right. Like, we can
exist. You have a healthy respect for the dinosaurs of today that we know as birds.
I do. I'm aware of their power.
Well, hopefully I will be able to convince you to enjoy bird music because actually, so there are kind of different types of bird vocalizations. It's not all bird songs. So a lot of the stuff you hear from, like, say, a crow or those, like, bird calls that you hear, it's technically not bird song. Although there's, with everything in evolutionary biology, like, the borders are kind of fuzzy. So bird calls are simple vocalizations that are often less pleasing to our human ears. And bird songs, which are longer, they're more elaborate, they're more complex, and we typically find them a lot more pleasing to our ears. So generally speaking, bird calls, like that raven staring at you, Joelle, going, brah! That is sort of a short and sweet kind of communication. It's often like an alarm, like, hey, watch out for that hawk, or like, hey, I'm over here, where are you? Or hey, stop that, or just, you know, generally these like little snippets of communication. Whereas bird songs are longer and more complex. So for example, I want to talk about the musician wren, which is a little rust-colored bird with white spots on its neck and dark bands on its wings. It's found in the Amazon rainforest, and there is a musician wren call, and I want you to listen to the difference between its call and its song, because it's quite remarkable. So here's the call. And here's the song.
It's like the difference between like a whistle as you're walking down the street and like a honk/whistle of trying to call someone's attention from across the field. It's very right. Different. That's crazy. So they... And all the, is it, okay, are birds like snowflakes for each of their song? Are different? Are they composing? Are they building off of one another? Is there a Bach-level bird who's like, that bird was a master songwriter?
Those are extremely good questions, and those are questions that are often the focus of zoo musicology studies and ornithology studies. So I would say that the answer is going to depend on the species of birds. Usually what happens with bird song is that you have your little baby birds and they have this instinctive understanding of which bird songs they're supposed to listen to pick up on somehow, which is interesting because bird songs do evolve over time. So that mechanism of them being like, ah, that's one of my family. I know I got to listen to that is kind of mysterious, but they do learn specific songs that like all of their species of birds are going to be doing. However, they also can in some species, and it differs, like some species have these big repertoires of songs. Some species just have a couple of songs. And generally you can have this big repertoire of like variations on these bird songs. And you could definitely have a Bird Bach who kind of like innovates a little bit and then passes that song on to other birds if it catches on. So there is bird innovation in songs, and it is really interesting to see that happen. It's partially innate. There's a partially instinctive ability to sing, and then it's partially learned, which is actually, you know, there's a lot of debate on how humans pick up on language, but there's sort of this idea that, you know, we have these structures in our brain that are really good at creating language, but then we have to learn it. So we learn it from each other. So it's a potentially similar things with birds, and we can learn a lot about human communication through bird communication.
Could we study I want a Jackson Family 5 birds. I want to see like the little Michael, you know, does Tito finally learn to like hit those dance steps at the right time? I feel like this is the most interested I've ever been in birds because it's a reality TV show waiting to happen. I want to see how the birds are evolving, what they're learning from their parents week to week. Are they getting stronger? Or are they frustrated that the judges don't like what they're doing? This could be very interesting.
They actually practice their song, and it is called subsong when they practice their song. It's kind of these little, like, very quiet, kind of uncertain little practicing, like, almost like they're singing the songs under their breath, like, okay, da-da-da-da-da, boop-boop-boop. And then, so they're kind of learning this song, and then as they get older and start to get more confident in their song, it starts to get stronger and stronger, and they will finally reach this age where they can actually sing and sing well. And the reason that they sing is that they are actually advertising that they're great birds. So
what? That's it. This is unbelievable. Wow. I didn't know that this is literally how humans, I feel,
yeah,
learn anything, the drums or, you know, whatever, like that's practice. Pretty cool.
Does that story remind you of getting ready to do your raps in front of your families? Were you like under your breath, like, let me just get the rhythm right?
Everything that she's saying, she's like, oh, they have this innate ability to da 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 da. We have an innate ability to either, some people can stay on beat or they can't, type of deal. So, yeah, I see a lot of similarities in how I learn music or watching maybe a child in my family learn music. So this is pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. And there's also, similar to humans, there's this crystallization period for learning bird song. So if you don't expose a baby bird to bird song when it's still immature, it actually can't learn it in adulthood, which is similar to how humans, we seem to have this period of time that where we can learn language. And if, like, say someone who is basically these children who have been like not exposed to human society, it's very, very rare that this happens. It's usually a lost child, and then they get lost somewhere where they don't have contact with other people, and then they get found. They struggle very much. They can kind of learn language a little bit, but they really struggle because it seems to be something that we basically have this crystallization period where, like, kids are great at learning language. It's astounding how smart and good they are at picking up on language just by absorbing it. And it's the similar thing with baby birds. They pick up this bird song and they learn it. And the whole reason they sing to each other is they're essentially advertising either to mates or to rivals that they are very talented, which means they're, which is sort of an advertisement of their overall health. So research has shown that high quality songs help indicate health. So there's a connection between the tempo of the bird songs and whether they have disease or parasites or their overall physical welfare. So, like, if they kind of, it's basically, if you have rhythm as a bird, it means you're healthy. And if you're kind of like maybe off key, a little bit off tempo, it means you might be dealing with some itchy skin mites or something.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah. Is there a song that we can sing as humans to find out if you're sick or not? That would be really cool if we could just like, oh, and then you know whether you need to go to the doctor or not.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's going to be show tunes.
Speak for yourself, Missy. I will show tunes my way through an illness. Let's do this. I'm ready for the talent competition as well. I would like an American Idol version of the songs. I think that they would be beautiful. And I do think that if humans could sing their despair, it would be more like a Glee episode with like, it'd be a lot of mashup songs. It would be people trying to express their feelings through multiple songs and singing terribly.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of Glee, actually, so like I said, there's two main reasons that Birdsong happens, and one is mating, advertising yourself to mate, like, hey, like, I have the mental acuity and the physical fitness to sing this amazing song, you should mate with me. But the other reason is to advertise to rivals that you're awesome and amazing and you can go at any time, bro, but we don't have to resort to violence because we can just settle this by seeing which one of us is going to be better at defending our territory through our songs.
Whoa.
And they have these, like, they have these song fights. So, like, there will be a bird singing in its territory. And usually, so typically, it's the male birds that sing.
So, the birds have rap battles. So, the
they
birds
do.
Are having rap
yes.
battles. That's yes. crazy. Oh, my God. I got to tell everybody that birds have rap battles. We're not
they
the
do.
Only ones. Oh my God.
They do. And they'll like compete with each other so one of the birds will sing a song in its repertoire and then another bird will sing either that same song or maybe a slightly different version of that song to say like, hey, anything you can do, like I can do better, essentially. And they'll go back and forth to both advertise themselves in front of mates, like, hey, you think this guy is good, like look at me. But also like to work out territory disputes without having to resort to actual fighting because they're like, hey, you know, like, listen, you don't want to mess with me. I have this extremely sick beat that you do not want to mess with.
Oh my God. I am mind blown right now. I got to take that to the classroom. Like, you got to teach them about birds and have them back. Yeah, that's really cool. Wow.
Do these battles ever get bloody? Does it ever go beyond just singing? And how is a winner determined?
A winner is determined by sort of the bird's taste in music. So again, like if it has the right tempo, if they have a big, sometimes in some species, if you have a bigger repertoire to draw from, that means that you are chosen more by mates or respected more by other birds. Like birds will, like if a bird is advertising its territory and it's a better singer by the metrics that these birds have chosen, then rivals will not challenge that bird as much because they're like, hey, you're probably kind of a badass and I don't want to deal with you. But yeah, it is. I think it's not that they never resort to sort of squabbles and violence. I think it is a way to avoid that, though, because if you can advertise your physical fitness without having to resort to violence, then it kind of works out for everyone because then it's like, hey, we don't really. A lot of animals do this, too, by the way. Like some animals do it by like comparing their jaw size. Like they'll open up their mouth and be like, oh, I have a bigger jaw than you. So we don't have to actually do this. And then it benefits them both because like the winner doesn't have to get any like expend energy or get any injuries from it. And the loser, you know, avoids probably what's going to be a losing. Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
a losing
man.
Confrontation. Nobody wants that. So, you know, music, it's a way to resolve bird disputes. I think that's great.
So powerful.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. 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 And like I said, so it's birdsong is generally something that male birds do, but female birds sometimes sing. So like, because males are often the ones that are advertising themselves to mates or defending territory, they'll often be, in a lot of species, they're the ones that produce birdsong. But in areas where birds actually have a lower risk of mortality, so like in the Amazon, where they have fewer predators and more resources, and also having a lower rate of mortality means that they can form these stronger pair bonds with each other because it's like, you know, it's more beneficial to be monogamous if your monogamous partner isn't going to get eaten by a cat or something. Mm-hmm. So in those areas, females actually also sing, which seems to indicate that, first of all, because that may strengthen their pair bond, and also in other areas where they have these shorter, unpredictable breeding opportunity windows, like in the deserts of Australia and Africa, where weather conditions are really erratic. Both males and females sing because it just increases their chances that they're going to find each other as quickly as possible while the conditions are right to breed. So it's really interesting how, like, these environmental factors really influence whether you're going to have a boy band or, you know, boy and girl bands.
So are the birds chorusing together? Is it multiple voices at once?
It can be. So sometimes it's a single bird singing a song of advertisement like, hey, come mate with me, or stay off my porch. Or it is, they can be duets. So a pair bond can sing a duet to strengthen their relationship, essentially. I mean, just like any sort of good musical.
It's like when your parents do the two-step in the kitchen and their bond yes. is like solidified.
Exactly.
I love that. So romantic.
Yeah. And then you can have like birds duetting as a form of rivalry, where it's like they're singing a duet to kind of like see who's the better singer. So yeah, it is really interesting. And there's, I mean, it really depends on the species of birds, because there's a whole variety of behavior. So I'm kind of like generalizing, but yeah, it's really interesting. And I love the whole thing of like birds singing duets together. It's so sweet. So romantic. And the way birds actually can produce music is really interesting, just on the sort of physics side of it. So birds don't have a larynx like humans do. They have a syrinx, which is, you know, the bird version of a larynx. So it's similar to how a larynx works, where air is forced past membranes that vibrate in a resonance chamber that produces sound. Kind of like the strings of a violin. When those strings vibrate, they produce a sound, and then you have the resonance chamber in the body of the violin. But what's interesting about the syrinx is that it allows them to create two notes at once, because they can control muscles on either side of the syrinx independently. So like how a pianist can like control both hands and play different notes at once, like a bird can play two notes at once.
You guys know there are humans who can sing two notes at the same time?
Yeah, isn't that the throat singing?
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Throat singing is incredible.
Polyphonic overtone singing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And it's, I gotta look this stuff up.
With throat singing, I think what's happening is basically what happens when you are switching from one register to another with singing, where it's like, now I'm not like a vocal expert with human singing, but you can, it's like switching from a certain register of singing to like a falsetto-ish register. It might not technically be falsetto. I apologize to all the vocal coaches out there that are just like, no, but it's basically, you have these two distinct registers of singing that happen in different parts of the larynx and different parts of the sort of like glottal area. And then if you basically get sort of like between them, or like right at that bridge between them, if you can kind of lean into that, you can get those two registers kind of like going simultaneously, and that's how you get that really interesting, incredible throat singing.
There's a ton of videos on YouTube if you guys want to look it up and check it out. Sometimes you'll see people like manually manipulating their throat trying to achieve that like dual tone. Some people can just do it with their like nose, and like just by opening their mouth at a certain angle and like getting the air to hit the chords. It is the craziest thing you've ever heard, though. You're like, I'm sure there are aliens in that person. This is a Men in Black episode, and they're just lying to us. We've been mind-wiped.
I remember I tried to do that when I first found out about it, and I just sound like, oh. Couldn't do it. Singing is not necessarily my strong suit, and I actually have an example of that.
Yes.
It's a wood thrush. This is what every morning in Illinois sounds like. I just want, if you live in the back country of Illinois where there are many a tree and cornfield, this is what you woke up to every morning. It is giving me very strange nostalgia, but it's also, it is very beautiful. This is one of the songs you just can't deny that it's just lovely.
I love the bird trills that, it almost sounds digital, like it's been auto-tuned, you know what I mean? Because I think it's one of those examples of it. It's playing two notes at once, so it sounds kind of synthetic and digital because you shouldn't be able to do that.
It's like going back and forth between. That's crazy. So what part of Illinois are you from?
Let's see. So I was born in Hazelcrest, which is like half an hour outside of Chicago. But I was raised in Ottawa, Illinois, which is like right next to Starved Rock, the big state park.
Okay. Okay, I've heard of these places, but I'm because I've heard this too. So I'm assuming is that like are these birds? Some of these birds in the Midwest, like you know, heavy in the Midwest. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's found in all over eastern United States, and then probably into the Midwest a little bit, and then I think it tapers off a little bit as you get closer to the West Coast.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, it definitely could have been the wood thrush or another species of thrush who also do similar calls.
I'm dubbing this the Beyonce of birds.
If you wanted her, you would have put a wing on her.
That was good.
Oh my God.
So one question that I had as I was doing this research is why does birdsong sound so good to us? Like, is it like human song? Like, what do we find so appealing? Because there's nothing better than, like, you know, you're out in nature and you're hearing birdsong and it's so relaxing and it sounds nice. Like, there's all sorts of interesting animal vocalizations, but sometimes they don't really sound nice. It's like, okay, that's interesting. I'm not into it, but it's cool. There was a zoomusicology study published in the Max Planck Institute of Ornithology that found that musician wrens, our little pal that we listened to at the beginning of the episode, share a similar taste in music as humans. So the intervals in their music, which is like the difference in pitch between two notes, are the same as intervals found in music in most human cultures. So I'm not a musician, so this quote from the article doesn't make much sense to me. So I'm hoping for musicians this will mean something. So the authors of the study say, quote, "It is because musician wrens preferentially produce successive perfect octaves, fifths, and fourths that their songs sound musical to human listeners." So great. Cool. I love it.
Some facts for you this morning. Take them. Oh my gosh. That's interesting. Now, I wonder if we took these birds to different concerts, like who they would rank high. Because like we know plants are classical creatures. They want to listen to their Bachs and their Beethovens. They're like a string and a trumpet, you know. But I wonder, like, you know, if we played, I don't know, some T-Swift for the birds, if suddenly, you know, sort of like they pick up on birds in the Amazon where foresting is heavy will sometimes make the sounds of the saws or the trucks and make that part of their environment.
That's the lyrebird, which there are birds that actually copy sounds. So they have such a flexible ability to fill their repertoire with different kind of sounds. They don't just do like sort of a species specific song. They copy all sorts of sounds they found. They can like you said, Joelle, just mimic exactly like a chainsaw.
I would like to see, you know, some bird renditions of the 1989 Taylor Swift album. I want to know how they feel about it, what their, you know, intonation of haters gonna hate is like. I think that would be brilliant. You know, if we got a boy band number of, you know, if we get 12 for like a K-pop band.
Right.
Done. What does that sound like? I feel like birds are holding back on us. As you know, I'm a bird conspiratist. I'm not one of the conspiracy people who believes birds don't exist, but I do believe birds are plotting for their takeover. And I wonder, like, you know, if they're just like, these humans are so silly. They think their music is great. They don't know. They don't know what's around the corner. I would like to hear it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have seen those birds in the videos, like cockatoo, who like sort of seems to dance to human music, seems to bob to the rhythm. I was actually talking to a listener, Brian Greco, who is an assistant professor at University of Wisconsin River Falls in the Department of Animal and Food Science, and I was asking him his opinion on like how animals respond to music. He was saying that sort of differences in tempo and the frequency of tones can have an effect on the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. So like sort of that's the same system that kind of engages you in excitement, fight or flight, or to calm down. And so he said, quote, this is well illustrated by the 5 jillion dancing parrot videos on YouTube. The vast majority of the selected songs are high tempo, and many of the featured birds are displaying fight, flight, or reproductive communication cues. So, and then he says, so music is exciting, be it scary or sexy. So birds are either finding the music to be a turn on and they're getting a little bit, you know, these are some thirsty, horny birds, or they are finding the music alarming and kind of feeling an excitement. It's possibly a fear excitement. It's hard to tell like the difference between fear arousal and excitement arousal. So it has something to do with the tempo and frequency. And I don't know how birds would react to T-Swift.
These birds are giving me very Mad Max vibes. It's sexy, but it's kind of scary. They like the loud, fast music. I'm telling you, overlords, they're coming for us.
So I didn't invite a NASA engineer on the show to talk about music just because she's super smart and space is cool, but because Deja is a musician herself. When we return, we're going to talk about how she uses music to inspire and educate students about STEM. It's simple, let me prove it. We gotta keep improving. We gotta get these grades, a degree, what we pursuing. I'ma show you how to do this. How to convert units. All my scholars, raise your hands. Cause we too busy schooling. It's simple, let me. X equals N is O. Negative B, that's a mode, square root of. B square minus 4 AC for sure. Now find a root over 2. Root over 2. Root over 2. What you were just listening to is another one of Deja's songs. So now let's go behind the music and get a NASA engineer's scoop on how songs can spread knowledge. So Deja, I wanted to talk to you a bit about your experience both as an engineer at NASA and as a musician. So first of all, for those of us who maybe aren't engineers, I'm pointing to myself. Can you kind of describe like what you do at NASA as an engineer?
As an engineer at NASA, I'm a quality engineer. So my morning starts off with me kind of going through a bunch of paperwork on some discrepancies that I may have found the day before. Discrepancies meaning that there's something wrong with a part, literally anything on the spacecraft.
We don't want that.
Right, exactly. So I go through those discrepancies, send them to the actual engineers that are, you know, working that particular system, and it's their job to take what I say and fix it, basically. And the quickest way to say that is just to fix it, right? So after I do all that paperwork, I go to different labs, I suit up, I put my mask on, I put my bunny suit on, got my booties on. I go in the lab and I start to, I inspect. I do a lot of inspecting on whether we're putting together something or we need to make sure that this part weighs this much, or we need to make sure that this mechanism can hold as much weight as it's supposed to. It could take this much force. It could exist in this temperature or any type of anything like that. We need to make sure that it's going to actually do what it's supposed to do in space. So I'm there to make sure that the proper steps are being taken to make sure that we can rely on what we're sending up there.
That sounds incredibly important. I am really glad that you are making sure that the things that we send into space are, you know, space worthy and not gonna fall apart. And when we think about things like, hey, let's just build a spaceship, it kind of hurts my brain to try to think about all of the many, many, many steps and many, many people who have to be involved to do mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. I don't even know where you start. Like just like look, staring at a blank sheet of paper and then like, I don't know, drawing a spaceship, like how do you even start with that?
But that's the thing, a lot of us don't even know where it starts. Like there's not one single person, they could give you the rundown, but But when it comes to actually doing it, it takes a massive amount of skill sets. We have to be a huge team. And some people don't like to admit that. They think that their part is probably more important than someone else's. But man, these you can't think that sending a rover to Mars can.
Right.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. That's incredible that you do that. When did you first realize that you wanted to become an engineer?
I started getting interested in engineering while I was in high school. We had these classes called Project Lead the Way, and they allowed you to design different like buildings like and things like that through a software called like AutoCAD. It was a lower version than what they use in the industry, but it was still giving us an opportunity to design things on our own and see how things worked. But I also had this little internship at the St. Louis Science Center called Youth Exploring Science, and they gave me a lot of opportunities to study things like explore, right?
Mm-hmm.
Things like chemistry, robotics, like just anything that you could think of, they were allowing us to do projects on them. And then they would take it a step further and put us into summer programs where we would actually teach it to elementary school. So
Deja, can you talk about the importance of exploring, about just being allowed to open space explore technology and
STEM? I just think that's where genuine learning comes from. It's just having that curiosity to see how something is working. How can I replicate that? How can I build that, right? And then another part of engineering is how can I make it better? How can I innovate this thing? So just having that genuine curiosity of, okay, how does my cell phone work? Do I have one that I can take apart? Okay, well, what's this thing? And then you just start Googling stuff and, okay, I got my answers. Obviously, it'll take a little bit more formal training to put bigger things together, but I do think that true learning and just being inquisitive, you got to teach kids to just explore the world around you, like look for answers. You can build whatever is in your hand. You can build that Nintendo. Like,
I think one of the really cool things that you do is you use music to help inspire kids to have that interest in exploring. How do you use music to inspire and to educate, especially when it comes to engineering and to math and science, these things that I think can be really intimidating mm-hmm. to kids?
So the music for me is about breaking down a barrier, more in particular, a language barrier. I feel like right now, education as a whole, not even just math and science, are given in a very, it's just one track. And we use the same words through every curriculum, and it's not very diverse at all. So if I always use this example, I remember I had, I don't know if it was a physics question or something, but it had something to do with like skiing or snowboarding on how fast this kid was going. And I had, you know, the people in my classroom, they had been to Denver or to any, you know, they had been skiing before, so they could imagine that, oh, I was going pretty fast as I was skiing, so I could imagine. You had that lived experience.
Right.
So when we break down the language and we start talking in a way that different particular groups of kids that they can understand, it's going to be a more enjoyable learning experience. So music for me, especially with black and brown kids, all kids love hip hop, but you know, that I know that's the music that touches my community the most. So let me try to break it down into their language. Like in my song, like 1 inch and 2.5 centimeters, your future brighter than the ring on my pinky finger. Like jewelry is so huge in the rap community. So let me mix some of that into the science stuff. So they thinking we singing about diamond rings and whatnot, but you don't even know that you're memorizing that. These conversions in the song.
Right. Because I think that's something that is often overlooked in education. We assume you get a textbook, you have a curriculum, and oh, that works for every kid. And mm-hmm. of course, no, you know, children are extremely influenced by their environment in which they grow up. You can't like teach a kid in New York, like, all right, so let's talk to you about surfing and use that as a metaphor for, like, it's like, well,
right.
Nobody surfs here. What are you talking about?
Exactly.
So it's just, I think that's incredible. I'm going to play a sample of one of your songs right now for our listeners to hear. First of all, because it's a really wonderful song. I love it. It's so catchy. Just to give you a taste of, like, how you can make something that, you know, if you tell a kid, like, we're going to learn about how to convert units, and you can feel their soul leave their body, but when you do it like this, it's so fun. I was listening to this, and I'm someone who, like, I don't remember unit conversion. Now I'm like, oh, right, yeah, this makes sense. I want to relearn this.
Oh, wow, that is awesome.
Yeah, so let me play that right now.
And 2.5 for centimeters. Your feature brighter than the ring on my pinky finger, 12 inches. It won't foot. You gotta keep your head in the bus. 3 feet. In one yard. The study show the teacher you a star. Okay. 1760 yards in a mile. Success to make your family really proud.
Could you talk a little bit about the creative process for you, like when you are creating an educational song, like how do you pick out a topic that you think would be really useful for kids to have?
Unit conversions. I came up with an idea to do that one because I was actually at work and we were trying to do a test on some type of part, and we had to put X amount of pounds in it on the piece of hardware, but our instructions were in kilograms, so we needed to convert that. And I literally was like, oh my god, I remember having to do this when I was younger, let me just make a song about it. Yeah, that's I'm choosing topics that touch a wide range of ages, demographics right now, until I get the resources to do, like, okay, this is first grade, this is second grade, this is third grade math.
What does music mean to you, and what does it mean to get to express your interest in STEM and engineering through music?
That is a really good question. Music is, I don't know, it's everything to me. I don't want to sound cliche, but when I first got out here to LA for my job, I was focused on the job. And I didn't get to express myself or do any music. And it really took me, like, I just was sad, and I didn't know why. Like, I just couldn't figure out. It's just like, you just got this really good job. You're moving to the West Coast from Missouri. Like, this is a great time. But what I realized, the missing key ingredient to what makes me happy is the music. So it's a safe haven for me. It's a way to just feel something, you know? I can't do it without it. But because of that, that's how I came with the idea to fuse the two. It's like, okay, these worlds have to be totally separate for me. I can mix them and also give back and teach at the same time, you know, and make and affect some change. So music, it's really huge in my life.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's I love that so much. I think music really taps into something so deep inside of us, and to use that to reach out to kids to make something that, you know, to sort of spark this scientific curiosity in them. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Music can educate, inspire, and it taps so directly into our emotions, maybe it can make us care about endangered species that may not be as cuddly as a panda or a koala. A listener, Talisker Diaries on Instagram, sent me a story about folk music that is about saving the bees. Climate change, disease, colony collapse disorder, pesticides have all caused a lot of problems for bee populations, for both honeybees and wild bees. Song Hive is an archive project started by traditional Irish fiddler Rowan Piggott, who is putting together folk songs about bees to stir up buzz about bees for bee-related environmentalist causes such as the Bee Cause. So here's a little musical sting in the key of B. This one is sung by Rosie Hodgson.
Bee! bees, hark to your bees. Hide from your neighbors as much as you please. But all that has happened to us you must tell, or else we will give you no honey to sell. A maiden in her glory upon her wedding day must tell the bees a story or else they'll fly away. Fly away, die away, dwindle down and leave you. But if you never grieve your bees will never grieve you.
I'm a worker by nature, I freely admit, and I spend all my days in the field. At a tiring old trade which may well be unpaid, which brings all the farmers their yields.
That was another song by Irish fiddler Rowan Piggott about honeybees. But to explore one of the most mysterious songs in the world, we need to get to know an animal that's over 500 million times bigger than a honeybee. So now I want to talk about one of the most incredible mysteries in animal behavior, and that is whale song, which even listening to it, I get chills because there's something so ethereal about it. Do you guys listen to whale song? Have you heard of it? It's a band called Whale Song.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. I can't wait. My spiritualist, when we're meditating, likes to play it. As we're talking about living in Los Angeles, I'll just reveal my whole Los Angelino self. So yeah, I've been meditating with the whale sounds.
Yeah. Nice. Well, look, I just play whale sounds sometimes too. So you're good here. So what exactly is whale song? So whale song is produced by two species of baleen whales, and that is what we basically know as whale song. So the humpback whale and the blue whale, the blue whale being the biggest animal ever. It's just huge. And then cetaceans, so that's the animals that the marine mammals that includes whales, dolphins. In general, they all communicate with these very complex vocalizations like clicks. They can even have dialects, like how the sperm whale seems to have these dialects of clicks. But whale song, as we know it, as the sort of like melodic variety of frequencies and tones, is specific to the humpback and blue whales. And so here is a humpback whale song, which sounds a little bit like a haunted violin. And here is a blue whale song, which sounds like we're in a sci-fi.
Oh my God. This is crazy. It makes me want to like take some tidbits out of it or sound bites and make a beat from it. Like I could definitely make some music from this.
Yeah. If you do that, let me know, because I would love to hear that.
Awesome.
You know, like when you hear a piece of music that just kind of brings you to tears a little bit, it makes you so emotional. I feel that way when I listen to whale song, where I kind of want to cry because it's like so there's something really hauntingly beautiful about it. Also, when you investigate the story behind whale song, it is still haunting because it's so mysterious and interesting, and it gives you this sense of the unknown that we know so little about the world's largest mammal, the world's largest animal even. So the way we hear whale song is probably different from how whales hear it, because we're listening with underwater microphones, then we're listening to a recording through our human ears. But the way that it hits whales is going to be different, because whales listen directly through the water and they don't have external ears like we do. They have these internal ears, and it resonates through their jaw and bones and fatty tissues and into their ears. I don't know what it's like to hear a whale song as a whale. We only know what it's like to hear a whale song as a human with our weird human ears. Mm-hmm. So that itself is pretty hard to try to conceptualize. There's something a little haunting about that when I think about, like, I can never really understand what it's like to hear a sound as a whale, because their experience of that is going to be so completely different.
Mm-hmm. I imagine if you put your head underwater and then cover your ears, like, real good with your hands and then, like, scream melodically under the water, we're probably getting close to what a whale is hearing.
Hang on, I'm going to be right back.
I'm going to go. Get my head under. Crying out.
Okay, now I'm wet. And I don't understand anything.
Don't try that at home. I feel like, don't do it, children. Your parents are going to be mad. We're going to get all kinds of phone calls. No good.
And our heads aren't really designed to hear sound underwater, whereas whales, again, it's like they have these resonant chambers inside their heads that lead to their ears, so the way they experience the sound is probably more full than we can as humans. And it's interesting because these baleen whales, at least these two species of baleen whales, have this like different method of communication than the toothed whales, the whales with teeth. And it may have something to do with the difference in basically their feeding behavior. So the humpback and blue whale may focus on hearing low frequency sounds for long distance communication, whereas toothed whales like dolphins, orcas, and sperm whales focus on higher frequencies to communicate and echolocate in their more immediate surrounding, because they actually hunt for fish, whereas baleen whales, like the humpback and the blue whales, they feed by taking in huge gulps of seawater and then smooshing it out through that baleen, which is that keratin structure at the front of their mouth that looks like a push broom all over their mouth. Mm-hmm. And then as they shove that seawater out of their mouth, inside of the bristles, all these little krill and other tasty little edible sea creatures get stuck in there, and then they just eat that up. So they're a much more passive feeder. They don't have to chase after any prey to eat it. Mm-hmm. So for them, having that immediate echolocation around them and immediate communication close by is not as important as perhaps more long distance communication to be able to locate other members of their group over long distances, or to find mates. It's also an interesting question about whether baleen whales actually echolocate. We don't really know, which seems like we should at this point know that about them, but we don't. There's some research that seems to suggest no, they don't really rely on echolocation, but there's other research that's showing that, like, hey, maybe their songs and their vocalizations actually could be used for echolocation. We don't know. That's always fun in science when we just don't know something.
I like the idea of a humpback whale or even a blue whale being their own GPS system, but it's like a very dope music. You know what I mean? So instead of like, we get boring, like, turn left here. They're like really general, like, turn left here. And it's like all, yeah, disco whales. I'm here for it.
Oh, disco whales. I love that. Yes, yes. Oh, that would be great. I feel like whatever research study comes out to see if these singing whales use that to echolocate, it should be called disco whales. And I won't accept anything else. The question is, what do they use their whale song? What do humpback whales and blue whales use their songs for? We kind of are going to get a little bit back into like what we learned about birds. So both males and females will do vocalizations, like these like sort of smaller vocalizations that seem to be more for communicating with other individuals close by to them. But those long, melodic, haunting songs is really just coming from the males. So that's a similar thing that we see in many bird species, where it tends to be the male birds singing rather than the females. So that may give us some hints about, like, this could potentially have something to do with mating, but we've never really observed blue whales or humpback whales mating, so we don't know.
These are private creatures. We study the hell out of these guys. We've never, like, once been like, oh, that's how they do it.
There's just not that much documentation on how their mating works. They are very, I think it's just the difficulty of, you can't, like, position researchers down under deep underwater for months on end just hoping something happens. Now, you'd think that there'd be an eccentric billionaire that creates a submarine that people can live in and, like, stalks whales and is like, come on, do it, do it, do it.
I'm trying to study. I like to think they're, like, puritanical and they, like, go, like, way, way down deep where there's no light and they're like, this is perfect. Like,
yeah, yeah. Intimate. They have like a cottage down at the bottom of the ocean, and, like, the whale groom is carrying the whale bride behind to the doors of the giant whale cottage, and, you know, or just like a God. Yeah. So what one thing that's interesting is that you can actually kind of identify groups of whales based on the songs that they're singing. So, Joelle, you asked a really interesting question at the top of the episode about birds, about, like, you know, do they have these individual songs? Do they change over time? And that's, we talked about what that is like for the birds, but for these whales, their songs slowly evolve over time and is specific to each group of whales. So you may have a group of whales from one region and a group of whales from another region, and their songs are going to be different from each other, and then they're also going to slowly evolve over time into sort of different types of songs. So, like, when you take sort of a slice in time of what's happening with these whales, it'll sound like they have just one song that this group sings, and that's true. Then, like, a few decades from now, that song's going to be a little different, but they are all singing that same song. So that's, again, really interesting. It just seems like these songs are actually part of the whale's culture that they learn, and then it evolves much like human music. It evolves over time, which is, I think, really interesting.
I feel you have to name these clans of whales. We need to merchandise them, give them, like, color coding systems or something so that people can attach, and, like, you pick your favorite Harry Potter house, you pick your favorite whale clan, and then you just really rock with that song. And then, I don't know how we can do it safely, because I know sonar is messing with the whales and the way they eat their patterns and swimming and stuff, but, like, if we could project the music back at them and be like, this is our remix of your ancient family song, and just see what the reaction is.
I feel like, can we sample you, please?
Exactly. We need to start partnering with our animal earth friends and make new music.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful.
Collab. But then we're just going to get into these, like, oh, is this post-industrial whale rock? Or is this, like, is this sort of, like, avant-garde whale rock?
That's, and
it's going to be
part.
Insufferable.
Categorizing.
It's going to be insufferable.
You're a scientist. This is the best part.
So, yeah, the purpose of these songs is highly mysterious. The leading theories are that it is used by males to find mates over long distances, used by males to induce estrus in females, that is, to make them ready to mate, which I'm not exactly sure about that one, but maybe.
Very white whales, I'm here for it. Give us the baritone, set the mood, sir.
And then it could also be as a way to communicate or to warn other males of their presence. So similar to birds, where it's like, hey, this is my territory. Like, we don't have to, like, I don't think whales really fight each other that much, but it's just a way of, like, saying, hey, let's, you know, we don't need to bonk into each other. We don't need to, like, compete over resources in this territory. Let's kind of maintain this distance so that we each have our little slice of ocean life. Could also be to communicate with distant groups. So, like, you know, you have a whale or two over here, and it's like, hey, how are you guys over there? But it's, like, way miles away.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. Whales on their cell phones, but they're just like,
right,
where are you guys? Do you want to get McDonald's, but it's see McDonald's.
That makes me think about evolution, period. Because say something, just say something catastrophic happens. You got the whales, they can communicate really far. You got the birds who can sing to each other and just communicate, but then our power goes out. What are we gonna do?
That's why we must form an alliance with the birds and the whales, so we have agents both in the air and in the seas.
Okay. I think we can make it work.
I love a plan.
There's actually some research on blue whales. Anna Sirvik and her team of oceanographers at Scripps Institute of Oceanography in La Jolla, California, which is actually in the same department that my dad works. So this is definitely nepotism and bias that I am, you know, full disclosure. But they did a study on blue whales, and they found that blue whales dive down deeper in the ocean to do their songs. And because the nature of the water changes as you get deeper, and like the water pressure increases and allows for further transmission of these sounds, it seems to indicate that they are diving down deeper in order to transmit their songs across further distances. So that does seem to indicate that these whale songs are for long distance relationships, whereas their other vocalizations, they are closer to the surface of the water. So that seems to indicate that is more for like sort of a shorter distance communication. So yeah, it's one of those things where when you're feeling like, oh, we already know everything about the natural world, what's left for me to do as a young aspiring scientist? It's like, no, we don't know anything.
Right.
There's so little we know. And I actually feel like, Deja, that the deep ocean is kind of similar to space in how mysterious it is.
Absolutely. Like, when you spoke about having a submarine that people, some tech whiz or something, said, having a submarine that someone could live down there or as deep as we possibly can go, that's the same thing in space. We're trying to get like hotels or just regular human space flight travel. So things are happening on both ends of the spectrum. It's actually pretty cool.
So that we can discover space whales.
Hey, that was...
Cosmic disco whales. God, I wish. So anyone listening who is an aspiring scientist, an aspiring evolutionary biologist, or anything in the field of STEM, listen to some music, get inspired, and please discover the mystery of whales, because maybe they know the meaning of life, and they're just singing about the meaning of life and all of life's answers, and we just don't know what they're saying.
Be the first to crack the code. You can do it.
Well, Deja, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you talking about the work you do and the wonderful music that you make. I will include a link to it because I feel like people really should check it out. It's such, I get chills thinking about just like combining music with education. It's amazing.
Nice.
Where can people find you?
So you can find me on my website at DejaWilliams.com, or you can follow me on Instagram, where I'm most present at Deja, DAJAE dot Monet, or the same thing on Twitter, but instead of a period, it's a underscore.
And Joel, where can people find you?
Oh, you guys know me. You can find me all over the internet at Joelle Monique. That's JoelleMoniqueUE.
And you can find us at Creature Feature Pod on Instagram, at Creature Feet Pod on Twitter. That's FEAT, not FEET. That is something very different. And you can find me at Katie Golden on Twitter, where, you know, just post my Katie thoughts. And as always, I am also at Pro Bird Rights, where, look, this wasn't bird propaganda, and I'll sue you if you claim it was. Thank you so much to the Space Cossacks for their super awesome song, Exolumina. Creature Feature is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts like the one you just heard, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or hey, guess what? Wherever you listen to your favorite shows. See you next Wednesday.